Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at cashfly.com. This is Floss Weekly with Chris DeBona, episode 8 for June 16th, 2006. Linux game porter, Ryan Gordon. So today, Chris, we have an interesting guest, and actually, as it turns out, a very timely guest. I didn't find out till three quarters of the way through the interview. Ryan is working on Google Earth.
Well, you know, I don't like to make this really all about Google. You know, I want it to be sort of about the guest and about free software.
Tell us about Ryan Gordon.
So Ryan, you know, I met Ryan many, many years ago in the .org pavilions at Linux World. And, of course, I knew about him online from his work on Iculus. And before that, when he did stuff for Loki. Loki was a game company.
Loki,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, so he was at Loki. He was there during its rise and fall.
They were the original Linux game porters.
Short. That's right. They shipped this version of Quake that was in this metal box that was just absurd. And he did a lot of work there, and he did a lot of great work on something called SDL, which is in the interview.
He worked on SDL as well.
Oh, yeah. No, Ryan's huge in SDL.
Oh, okay.
SDL is Ryan. I mean, I hate to say it. No, that's not fair. There's a lot of people who work on SDL, but yeah, he's done a lot of work there. And he's actually a really big proponent of something called the Open Audio Layer, OpenAL.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. If you're going to be developing games for multiple platforms, you know who Ryan is through his work, if not through his name.
Yep. You're using his stuff.
Yeah.
Well, he's a fascinating fella, has done a lot of work porting games, but is also a very interesting philosopher, I found. So yep. Without further ado, let's meet Ryan Gordon. I started by asking him, what's the best way for teenagers to get into game programming?
The funny thing is, that's not a teenage phenomenon. I have 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds coming up to me going, I want to write video games, you know. The need to create is not a youthful endeavor. I mean, I think that generally we associate it as such because the most radical art always comes from younger people. But, you know, that's not an urge that fades out as you get older. And, you know, I tell them, you know, this is Floss Weekly, so I'll go with the open source angle, which is what I always go with in this case. The best, no jokes, you know, jokes aside here, but the best way, if you want to make a video game, the best thing you can do is get the Quake 2 source, the Quake 3 source, the Duke 3D source. You know, there's the Comanche source. There's as time goes on, there's a pile of games. I'm not talking, you know, little amateur games that someone made, not to diminish those, because, you know, writing Tetris is good for the soul. Everyone should do it once, if not twice. But
Have you written a Tetris, Ryan?
Hasn't everyone?
not me, but I'm not a programmer.
You should.
Well, two out of three Floss Weekly participants today have.
All right,
Chris,
high five, dude.
Chris,
yeah, all right. All right.
You've written
rock and roll.
You've written a Tetris, Chris?
I wrote a Tetris clone shortly after one came out.
Nice.
So, you know, a long time ago.
Tetris is the perfect example because you can implement, if you have a programming background, even not a video game background, you can implement it in a night and debug it by the morning with enough coffee and Coca-Cola. But
pizza.
And pizza too, sure. Why not? There's a secret formula. You have to have the right proportions of all the junk food. But it's simple enough to start, but there's a sort of reverence, and I say this as someone who just bought the Nintendo DS version of Tetris yesterday after buying the Game Boy version and the Nintendo version and a Mac version before. Game developers specifically look at this and go, this is the simplest game ever, and it's possibly the most addictive game ever. You know, everyone wants to write that game. And I don't mean they want to do a Tetris clone, but they want to, you know,
have the addictive simple game.
They want to find that magic thing.
And they can look at it and say, oh, I get how you would write something like this.
Yeah. I mean, well, what's important about Tetris is that, not that algorithmically it's simple, but the rules of it are simple. It's like chess. You learn it in an hour and you spend your life frustrated by it, trying to master it. And, you know, so from that point of view, everyone should write Tetris just as something. Everyone should write Tetris as something.
The farthest I got is the Towers of Hanoi, and that was about it. So,
well, it's a start.
I'm grade school level as far as that goes.
Well, recursion might be grade school level, but it's half the game.
True,
you know,
true.
After that, once you learn pointers, you know everything you need to know about programming. After that, it's just syntax. So
but you were pointing out that, and I think this is really wonderful, is that people like id have released the source code of these older games, and they can actually look at what really good programs. How well commented is that code?
I'm trying to think who I can offend because I might have to have a contract with these people.
John Carmack is listening.
Well, in Carmack's defense, Carmack actually writes really good code, and he has no qualms about some things are going to be hacky because it's sometimes that's the best thing to do. I think it's really instructive to look at the Descent 1 source code, which I don't know if you've ever played Descent. It was a DOS game.
Super 3D.
Yeah, it was.
It made a lot of people nauseous.
Yeah, motion sickness supreme, but it was a brilliant game. But and more importantly, technologically, people looked at that, and we had seen Duke Nukem 3D, and we had seen Doom, and Descent was a little more than incrementally better than that technologically. And people went, my God, how do you do that on a computer? How is that even possible? And a couple years after the game was done being on shelves and stuff like that, the developers released a source code to it. And there's a README file in it that's very instructive because they did an interview with the developers before the release and stuck it in the source code archive. And the questions are things like, is there anything of value in the source code that you'd like people to look at and learn from? And they're like, no. It's like, well, what do you mean? Isn't there something in there you're proud of? They're like, no. In fact, this is the worst code we've ever looked at. So you have to understand that there's programming elegance and there's game development. And game development... Oh, you're laughing, but I mean, game development is about making the right concessions and faking it the best you can to get the product to work. I mean,
so to paraphrase Steve Jobs, game developers ship.
Yes, actually, exactly. Well, not all game developers ship. And the ones
good
that
game
don't
developers
ship. Well, in the game development circles, we talk about the ones that don't ship the same way that people in real life talk about, the character in Friday the 13th that got killed by Jason. You know, they're the ones that didn't make it because they couldn't handle it, you know.
And they had to go into the basement and look at the
Switch box. But you're sympathetic because they're but for the grace of,
They're but for the grace of good management and people
Ada
that are
Lovelace,
to...
there go.
Boy, this is a painful conversation.
we do know somebody who never shipped. I don't know.
Oh,
one
yes,
out
yes,
of they're... three people on Floss Weekly.
That's okay. I haven't shipped on things before, too. And it's painful, you know. If you want to cry a little bit, I'm here for you, man.
I'll mute the microphone.
No.
Bring the show down.
That's good radio there, man. You keep that mic up if you're going to cry.
I'm actually fascinated by this subject. You know, I've always been kind of...
Seminole Vesicles?
I've always been an amateur programmer, and now that I'm old, I can't do it anymore, but I always loved it.
You're never too old. What? You're never too old.
Don't you think you get a little... Well, you're too young to know this yet, but wait till you're 50.
Yeah, tell it to Vince Cerf. How old is he? He's got to be at least 20.
Is he writing code?
The stress makes him look like
this. Is he coding, though?
No.
If he's not, I'm going to be angry.
He's not coding.
He's not coding. He talks to Congress.
Yeah.
He keeps them off our back.
He's not writing code.
You're breaking my heart here, man.
I talked to Waz about this, and he said around about 45, he stopped doing designs because he just couldn't hold it all in his head anymore. And I think
I think it's children. Once you have children.
It might be. There's a certain something to programming. One of the things is, of course, it's a focus, but you do have to hold a lot of loose ends in your head as you're working. And that ability does diminish.
I don't know that I agree with that. I honestly think that once you have children, you stop programming all night.
Well, that's another thing.
And
you
so
have
you
a
get
life.
Practice.
Yeah, it's not children, it's a life.
Yeah.
What's this life thing you speak of? All I do is write games. But
how many hours a day do you code, Ryan?
An absurd number.
I don't really keep track because I think if I kept track, I would stop doing it, and that wouldn't be good.
But you love doing it. Are you? I mean, when you're doing it, are you having fun?
Sometimes more than others. That's the nature of
what's fun for you.
Programming.
What do you like? The challenge, the problem, the design.
Programming is just all programming is just a expression of a solution to a problem. I mean, that's all it is. So yeah, I guess seriously, it is. Even the boring parts and the exciting parts is just how do we store these bits efficiently? How do we get these packets over a wire as fast as possible? I mean, we might look at it at higher levels, like how do we do voice over IP? But ultimately, it comes down to a series of small integrated problems that you solve one by one. I mean, that's of course I love that. It's the very nature of it. But let's get back to open source.
Okay.
Because we got distracted with the whole mic stand thing. But I want to comment on this because we're talking about people coming in and you know, saying, I want to write video games. And, you know, first off, I pat them on the head and give them a lollipop and send them on their way. It's like, sure you do.
No, you know what I do is I say, before you write video games, you need to get the tools that come with many video games for designing levels. Do some level design. See if you're comfortable with that aspect of it.
Well, yes and no. Ultimately, what you're telling people when you tell them to get mod tools is you're saying that you writing Half-Life 2 is too big of a problem for you. You want to start smaller, but I don't think you actually need to have... You don't have to start with, you know, Unreal Script or Half-Life 2 scripting or, you know, making a mod for Doom
3. Where would you start?
I'd start with Tetris. Seriously, I'm not.
No, I agree with you. I think you're
not kidding, and you're not alone. You know, Andrew LaMoth, when he was asked, you know, how do you start off? It's like, well, go do a Pac-Man.
Write a game.
Pac-Man, Tetris. If you're really, really advanced and determined, write Super Mario Brothers 1.
Not a 3D shooter though.
Definitely not. And even though those tools are available, that you could mod, you know, you could mod Half-Life or Unreal 2004 to, you know, get that basis of the 3D engine stuff. Now you're not worried about video games. You're worried about, you know, 3D vectors, and you're worried about.
Right. And I guess in a way that's what I was saying, which is, do you really want to be a programmer or do you want to be a game designer? If you want to be a game designer,
well, that's a problem too. But
do mod tools. If you want to be a programmer, yeah, write Tetris.
Well, exactly. And there's two camps. And you're absolutely right. Because there are people that go, I want to make games, but what they're saying is I want to design games.
Which is very different. Somebody else to do all the art and the work, and yeah. I just look over the shoulder and tell them when they're wrong.
And those people are a problem. Not that those in the room or anything like that, but just teasing.
Dude!
but there is a legitimate market for game designers. I mean, it's a hard job, but it's a great gig if you can get it. But what I'm saying here is that There are people, and whether they're open source people or professional commercial closed source developers, that just think this is going to be a sexy new life for them. One, they're probably mistaken, but the ones that actually do want to write video games, the entire trick there, whether you know how to program, have a background in it, or you're brand new, the total trick is not getting overwhelmed on the first day. You don't want it to turn into an intellectual exercise where you get, you know, 50 lines into it, you set up a web page for your project and
make the t-shirts
and then on Cafe Press and then never
and that's it
actually write code. You go, okay, what do I do now? Where do I start?
So you say, you know, write a little bit first, write a small working prototype or
something you can run.
Don't even say prototype, say something you can run. Thank you, that's the best way to put it. I mean, this isn't even true of game development so much as programming in general. Like, I have a lot of people go, oh, I totally want to be a programmer. Well, why do you want to do that? That's the first question. Is, you know, I want to, you know, do you want to create something, or did you just hear this was cool? I don't know when programming became cool, but you know, you get my point. But there's people that do that, and they say they want to do this, and then they don't know what a for loop is, they don't know what a pointer is, and you know, they get to like hello world, and they go, that's cool, I can do more, and then they have to build something that needs like a linked list and a hash table, and they go, I don't know how to do this, I give up, I'm going to go watch Friends on television. And
do you have to read Knuth, or do you have to take comp sci to be a programmer?
Would it be bad if I told you I've never read Knuth?
I have Knuth, but I've never read it.
I have it too, and I've never read it.
I read the Bubble Sort chapter, you know.
Everyone reads the Bubble Sort chapter. I read the introduction where he compares it to cooking, and I thought that was a very good way to put it, because Knuth, having not read the rest of the book, Knuth figured it out in the introduction that you don't want to overwhelm people.
Right.
As soon as you overwhelm people, and you see this if you ever take like a college or a high school level programming class, there's always two people that are smarter than the teacher, you know. The vast majority, like 80% of the class, will be average. Like, they can get through these programs, right, and they can sweat it out and get there. And there's three or four people that are struggling,
right,
and they sink and die every time.
So, but you're saying you need to learn some classical computer science things, like, you know, data structures and so forth, before you go.
I wouldn't formalize this so much. I mean, my education in programming has really not been terribly formal. So
did you study it in school or
no? I have a degree in English and drama.
See, I love this. That's great. I mean, I think that's fascinating.
I think computer
science. How did you
learn
to program then?
I taught myself, like every good programmer. Not to say I'm a good programmer.
That may be changing. I mean, I think in the early days that's true.
No, I completely disagree with you.
Okay, you're wrong.
I disagree that. That it's not people who adopted themselves. I believe that a traditional computer science degree is, it can be very important and do a lot for people, but if they don't have that native curiosity,
you gotta love it first.
Yeah. You know, they can't. Well, they're not the developers you want.
And that's what I'm talking about. And ultimately, if you had to pick one word, the word is initiative.
Curiosity.
If you want to formalize it, it's initiative. If you want to romanticize it, it's curiosity. But they are the same thing.
Well, take us on your journey, Ryan.
Tell us about you, Ryan.
Tell us about, when did you start? How old were you? 13, 14?
I'm 33, vegetarian. And,
really?
No, I'm just kidding.
We
no,
know
I'm
that either, story already.
Yes. I went through your archives of your podcast, and now I'm making fun of you. Sorry, Miguel. Actually, I am a vegetarian, but I'm not 33. But what is my journey, did you say?
Yeah, how did you get started with computers? What was your first program?
Take us back to
your first computer.
I should say we're actually recording this in Google's Mountain View facilities, and in one of the buildings, in all the buildings, there's whiteboards on the walls in the hallways, and people write silly things.
I know
on
exactly
that.
What you're about to talk about.
Yes.
I love that wall.
Yes, I started that wall. But,
gosh, so cool.
There's whiteboards everywhere, and you can just people write silly things like I don't know what's wrong with the internet or something like that, and just people as they walk by will add comments to it, you know, and some really interesting things and some silly things come out of it. But you know, one day in the middle of the night, when we're recording this, we actually just shipped Google Earth for Linux, so just to give you a time frame on when this was recorded. But a couple weeks ago, when I got here and I was walking around sleep exhausted in crunch time for Google Earth, I walked by one of the whiteboards and it was empty, so I wrote on it, you know, thing that got you into computers in the first place. And almost every single answer that's on there, because it's been up there for a few weeks and people write on it when they go by, and almost every single answer on there is a video game.
Gaming. You bet.
Gaming.
Me too.
And the ones that aren't gaming are almost always BBSs, modems.
I did both.
Yeah, games and communication. Yep. And it doesn't seem an accident to me that those two things are merging.
See, but mine was ego. 10 points. This is great.
I thought that might be the Chris on that, but...
Chris was deluded, by the way.
A1, yeah.
Jokes aside, I think a lot of people probably wrote that as a first program. It wasn't Hello World. It's, you know, Ryan Rocks or something.
Yeah, over and over and over.
Mine was, but, you know, whatever. But, okay, fine. Communication, video games, and ego. Frankly, isn't that what drives most computer development? And
yes.
Porn. But, you know, we won't get into that here. No one listed that, but no one had the shame, you know, I guess. I don't know.
I don't think... I wonder if that's the case, though. I mean, I really think it is probably more... First of all, you're...
That's kind of a user problem.
You're pretty, it's a user problem. Yeah, and you're young when you start this, and I think it's pre-adolescent when you really get hooked. Were you 12, 13? How old were you when you really got hooked?
I was very young. I couldn't give you a time, because I had a Commodore 64 my dad brought home, and my dad was a filthy pirate, like I guess everyone was back then, and I love him for it, because he brought me things like Raid on Bungling Bay, and Rescue on Fractilus, and Elevator Action, and more importantly, Ghostbusters for the Commodore 64, which was...
Your answer to that.
Which was mine up there, but you can pick any number of people from my generations and ask them, if you like computers, what made you like them in the first place? And they're going to say Karateka. They're going to say Prince of Persia. Yeah. They're going to say, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
True of my generation, true too, and probably of current generation.
And the deprived ones will say Oregon Trail. But
oh, that's sad.
and the generation before me will say they found the Colossal Cave Adventure on Mainframe.
Look at
and
me.
They were
that's
hooked.
Right. That was the first game I played.
Yeah, and you look at entire generations have been built on that.
I tell parents that, because parents often worry about their kids playing video games. I said, look, that's the best way to introduce them to computers.
Well, I'm a little torn on that. I mean, you know, and I say this as someone who actually did ports of Postal 2, but...
Oh, you ported Postal?
Yes, to Linux and Mac.
I'm shocked. That's the most repulsive game I've ever played.
Actually, it's not. The most repulsive game is probably... the most repulsive games are the anti-Semitic games that come out of the neo-Nazi
There's worse
camps,
stuff. No, I
and you have not ported those.
And I haven't. Well, I wouldn't. No. Even, not that anyone's asking me, but, you know, I wouldn't.
I mock Postal 2, but I've played it, and I just wouldn't let my kid play it.
Well, no. I wouldn't let my kid watch porn, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have a free speech right to when he gets older, or First Amendment right now, free speech right. But, I mean, everything's about moderation. I mean, there's nothing wrong with putting a warning sticker on an album saying this album's going to have naughty words on and some F-bombs, and you know, we might have to put that on this podcast by the time we're done. But
I always edit the F-bombs out.
Ah, geez.
Right, I'm that kind of guy.
That's nice of you.
No, but, you know why? Because I think it's really important that 13-year-old who's really into this subject gets to hear this.
Well, sure. And I think it's important. But I mean, in terms of Postal 2, I mean, Grand Theft Auto was done with a straight face. Like, they really said, hey, we're going to beat some hookers here. you know, but
right. No, Postal 2
is
just totally,
is very tongue in cheek. Yeah, no. It's very much like this is violent because your society is violent. And you don't realize it. You're a victim of violence in all your media, and you're fat. You have fast
it's
food in your
funny.
Gut. And
it is.
So I'm going to defend Postal 1 right now.
Okay.
I thought Postal 1 was genius, and let me say why. Yes, it was all that. It was this big commentary, yada yada yada. It was fun to play, but more importantly,
it was Robotron, basically.
Well, it was Robotron, but when you played it, you notice that the actual storyline is somebody you think is going crazy, thinking that the world is being invaded by aliens, and he's got to kill them all off. And this is, and of course, you're watching this, and it's like this is awful. But you remember that last level in Postal 1?
It's him and.
Him in an elementary school, which is like, you know, way, you know, beyond. And how does it end, though? Can you kill the kids? No, the kids kill you. Because it turns out they are aliens coming down to attack the world and all this stuff,
well,
right?
Yeah.
So this redeems this in your
no,
mind?
No, I'm not saying it redeems Postal.
We lose creative consistency sometimes, I guess, is what we're saying here. But no, I mean, it's meant to be commentary, and it's meant to be shock value in the same way Howard Stern is. I don't want to really get off onto this.
No. I want to get back to programming. I think that's an interesting sideline. But
I just think it got a bad rap. And,
So you're a young guy. You're playing games. Did you get... I guess you had that impulse that I talked about right at the beginning. Boy, I think I could, or I would like to, write some of these.
I don't think I actually really started out with video games. To be honest with you, and this is probably why I do more Linux porting than original game development, is that I've always loved the plumbing level of things, like the stuff you don't see. That's really interesting to me. But to a certain degree, I mean, I heard Eric Raymond give a talk once before Eric Raymond was, you know, a caricature of himself. And he was talking about how open source is really good because, you know, the things we think are impressive now aren't going to be impressive for long, and how there's a sense of wonder that when you first loaded up the original Doom, you said, oh my God, I never imagined that you could do that with a machine this, you know, underpowered as a 386DX, you know. And I think that there's a certain amount of wonder in that we go, you know, we see Ghostbusters on the Commodore 64, we see Mario 64 for a later generation where you go...
Wing Commander 2.
Or Wing Commander. Yeah, you can pick any number of games where you went, you know, this game is clown shoes today compared to what's out there, but there was such a magic to that. But the secret here is that the people that see that, they don't go, well, okay, I'm sure some of them do go say, I want to make, you know, or World of Warcraft actually is probably the modern day example of this, but they don't go, I want to make that game or I want to clone that game. And they go... I want to stand on the shoulders of giants, and I want to do the next thing that's like, you know, if this is what we're doing now, in 20 years, you know, when I'm a smarty man game developer, you know, what can we pull off? What can we create? I mean, it's got to be like the artists in the Renaissance looking at the Sistine Chapel going, this is just the beginning, you know? I mean, to certain degrees, I think that's the most important thing, and I don't think any child or teenager, most adults can vocalize that, but I think secretly it's not, I want to make games because they're cool. I think subconsciously at a primal level, we're looking at that and saying, you know, this is archaeology, this is history, this is art, this is what we build on top of.
And that brings us back to open source, because what is better for building on top of, but
open source. And well, more importantly, what is open source gives you something really unique that you can't get from playing Wing Commander or whatnot, in that you have games that have shipped, and this is really Carmack's baby, that he said, we're doing something unprecedented. We're giving you not just the source to Doom 1, but we're giving the source to Doom 1 under the GPL. And that was wildfire. And now other companies are starting to, you know,
get this.
Yeah, and the gates are breaking down. And the next one is really picked up on this was 3D Realms. And there's been other source releases between there, but 3D Realms said, okay, well, Rise of the Triad, we're never going to make a dollar off this game anymore. Yeah, we'll happily sell you a disc with the data files, but here's the source, and here's the source under the GPL. And here's and they tried that. They put their toes in the water, and that went really well. And they said, well, here's a game that sold really well for us and frankly still sells well for them. Duke Nukem 3D, source code, go. And the interesting thing about this is that I mentioned briefly archaeology there, but this, open sourcing these games, the first thing that happens with them is that the archaeologists come out and they start restoring these things. They start saying, okay, this was fun on DOS, and I want to play it on Linux. I want to play it on Mac. I want to play it on Windows XP because the DOS version won't start up
anymore. My cell phone.
Or on my cell phone. And you see like PDA versions of Quake 2, which is crazy, you know. But
iPod versions.
An iPod. Has there been an iPod?
Yeah.
Yes, I saw that actually.
Insane.
Not of Quake 2, of Doom, I think.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't think anyone would play that on iPod and say this is going to be a great gaming experience, but But the archaeology of that is not lost to the world. I mean, they've cracked open King Tut's tomb and pulled out the Doom 1 source code. And so, to a certain degree, the first wave of people
really?
To come in for that... Well, yeah, little did you know, under those bandages was a floppy disk. But
I totally see what you're saying. I mean, this stuff is significant. It's more than just a game, I think. It's significant culturally. It's art.
Exactly. Precisely. Okay, so the first wave of people come in are the people who clean it up. Iculus.org is very good about taking, which is my site. I don't mean to pimp it, but this is we're kind of the primary site for this sort of thing.
Say
but,
it again.
Yeah. You know, Iculus.org, I-C-C-U-L-U-S.org. But and really, I didn't come on here to pimp the site. But
it's okay.
Do you do this commercially, or are you doing this just as an open source developer?
Just as an open source developer.
Wow. Right? Well, you're not like a Mac Play or somebody where you're making money on this.
No. So what Ryan, let me pimp you, Ryan.
Oh,
so what Ryan does for a living is he goes to companies like the Googles of the world and the IDs and 3D Realms and pick your favorite
Epic Games.
And they go to him and they say, Ryan, we really need a version of this for Linux. Not necessarily because they think that people are going to play it on Linux, but because they need the server versions of the games.
Well, and
they pay him for it.
Well, and they pay me for it. And that's where I make my money is, you know, I do commercial porting of stuff to Linux and Mac and just... I look at well, we're going to get off on a tangent here. I'm sorry about this, but we'll get back to the open source video game thing. But I look at there's a lot of people out there that want to push the GNU Linux platform, and there's people that want to push the Mac OS platform and such like that. I think that the most important thing is not pushing a platform, but pushing lots of platforms, because if you get to the point where people go, I'm trying to think how to put this. I get so much email from people that say, you know, I like the work you've done, and I'm stuck on Windows, and I would totally be able to delete this Windows partition if I could just have this one game on Linux. Whatever this one game is, it changes from person to person. Or if I had, you know, Google Earth on Linux, which, by the way, is shipping now from earth.google.com for Linux, Mac OS, and Windows.
Watch him pimp.
Well, yes.
It's not really about Google, this thing.
Sure, yeah, but so. I'm kind of proud.
He's proud of the work he did.
I slept under a desk for a month to port that, and I feel really good about how it turned out. So, but it's not you can't force the GNU system. You can't you can't force Linux onto people, and you can't force Macs onto people, because every operating system has its merits and flaws. But one thing is certain is that right now we have kind of a homogenous environment of Windows across the planet. So if you break down that barrier and not say, well, you can either have Windows or Linux, but you start getting to the point where you can go, you can have Windows or Linux or Mac, or if you're crazy, BIOS, or if you want to point stuff at your toaster, okay, we can do that too. The more of that you can do, the more you can add this sort of platform confusion to the planet, you know, the more you've you're opening options. And, you know, if you want to, I hesitate to use the term the Windows monopoly, I guess it is, but, you know, if you want to break down these walls, these crystallized walls of, you know, Microsoft dominance and Windows dominance, this is the way to do it. If you force Linux down people's throat, they'll puke it back up. If you force the Mac down people's throats, they'll puke it back up. If you give them an option to do whatever they want, then they will. You know, if you build it, people will come. So the way I make my money is I'm a freelance developer, and I port things to strange platforms. You know, if it can level the playing field a little bit by doing that, that's what's important to me. And, you know, getting paid is nice also. But aside from that, Iculus.org, what we do is we have open source developers. And if a game gets open sourced, we'll pull it into like CVS or Subversion now and start, you know, doing a port ourselves. And inevitably, this is what I was going to say, you have that first wave of developers that come in, and they port things to different platforms, love their Windows and their Mac OS versions and Linux versions of a game. The second wave of people are the real artists, where they go, I'm going to add per pixel shading bump maps and vertex shaders to Doom 1.
Or I'm going to turn Free Space 2 into a Battlestar Galactica sim.
Exactly. And these people start building on the shoulders of giants, and they start, you know, genuinely creating. Now, Iculus.org, what we do with games is we clean them up and we port them to different platforms, and we want them just to be a stable base. You know, it's like, this is going to run as the original developer intended, but it's going to run on your platform. And then from there, you know, when someone does that super cool, crazy game built on top of that, it's going to run on your platform. You're not going to be like, ah, oh, someone did this awesome thing with the Quake 1 engine, but oh, it's Windows only. You know, if we strive to get people a base for that, then it makes it a non-issue because they'll build on top of those bases instead of building off the original source and such. So we try not to taint the code too much. We try not to, you know, change the original developer's intentions. Like, we just added OpenAL support to Quake 3 so that you can get true 3D surround sound, depending on what kind of drivers you have and stuff. But, you know, we consider that a benefit, but we don't. We want the game to look the same. We want it to play the same. We want someone to take that code and make it not play the same, make it do something crazy with it. And you see a little bit of that on Ikkyosid.org. Some of the other projects we host, like Dark Places and such like that, where they're really building something impressive on top of these things. But so that's my own personal interest on Ikkyosid.org. But we also just, if you have a good idea for a project, we like to think of ourselves as a very small Source Forge. We used to joke that we were SourceForge with soul. Sorry to SourceForge people if you're listening.
I think Chris DeBona might be listening, but I might be wrong. I don't know.
No, actually, he's nodded off. I've talked too long at this point. But
I'm sorry. Was I insulted?
No. Talk a little bit about your process. I mean, you're getting code that is written for Windows.
Yes.
It's probably pretty tightly tied to Windows, unless the programmer is unusually good. I mean, do you have to do a lot of decoupling, or is it done? And how much information do they give you? I mean, do they give you the code and you get time with a developer and say, well, what does this do? What does this do?
Or I never get time with the developer.
So you're on your own?
I don't ask for it because they don't want to give it. Wow. And I don't blame them because, you know, developer, by the time I get it, it's very rare that I'm doing. Well, not, they're not through, but they're almost through. And that's the time. That's like, don't feed the bear. Don't touch the bears. Right. Don't tap on the glass, you know.
So you must spend a good portion of your time just reading the code. I mean, how many lines are we talking about?
I can tell you very little about most of the games I've ported.
You don't play them?
No,
he means he doesn't know.
I don't see the source.
Well.
If I know something about the source, it means I had a problem.
You don't
with that
see the
spot.
Source.
I see the source, but I don't like.
He doesn't play archaeologist with the code.
Yes,
well, how do you port it then?
Well, if I had to break it down to mathematical steps, the first thing you do is you push it through GCC and
see if it compiles.
Yeah, and it never does. But
of course not, right.
But you start working. You focus on the places where it doesn't compile, and then if something doesn't compile because it's got some Windows 32 API in it, you stub that piece of code out. You put a little printf there saying, you know, come back to this later, and you keep going.
Right.
You're laughing. This is how it actually works.
No, I believe it. No.
And, you know, once you get to the point where it's building, compiling, and linking, you run it, and usually you get a bunch of printfs saying, come back to this later, come back to this later.
Right,
and
right.
Then you start filling in those printfs with legitimate code. And
so a lot of what your work is knowing the Windows API and knowing how to translate that into X window.
Yes, to a certain, well, you never write to the X window layer directly. You always use something called SDL, which we'll get to in a second
because
an open source project. But, I mean, I know enough about the WinAPI to know where to find things on MSDN and know how to find related, you know, the Microsoft Developer Network webpage. But, and the thing is, it's not knowing the Win32 API because I've discovered with the Win32 API that it doesn't matter how well you know it. There's always some arcane side effect you have to look up.
Yeah, we had an interview with Jeremy Allison.
Okay, and you deleted it. I heard
this so. Week.
What?
Oh no, we
re-recorded.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
good.
Check it out.
We have
good.
Both.
So yeah, it's not. I know you're asking me a lot of things, like, so you do it like this. I'm going no to everyone.
No, this is great. I want to know how you do it. No, this is why people are listening.
Generally speaking, the source code that I port, like, this is what I'm saying, is I don't spend a lot of time looking at the source code, because if I'm looking at it, it means I'm having a problem with it. Like, it wouldn't compile. Or,
right. No, I'm understanding a little bit. So
yeah.
that makes sense.
And then when you get further along, you start having the game running a little bit, and then you have to actually start digging in and saying, okay, you know, why is this polygon not rendering or whatnot like that? And those things you have to get a lot more intimate with the source. Ideally, you don't want to look at that. But the interesting thing about this is what I was saying. You said, do you just get a chunk of Windows code? And the answer is yes, sometimes. Tolstoy once said about families that, you know, every happy family is the same, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own special way. Source code is very much the same for video games. So, you know, the ones that just work are all the same. The ones that don't work are all fun and unique in their own way. So I think that the trend you're seeing, though, is that in the AAA, you know, blockbuster mega game titles, it's too expensive to develop them from scratch. Across the board, it's too expensive. So people at this point are almost universally licensing a game engine, and it's almost always either Unreal or Doom 3 or Half-Life 2. So what I did a couple years ago, and I got a, when I first started out doing this as a professional, I got a very lucky break that Epic Games called me and said, you know, through a series of lucky events, we hear you could do a Linux dedicated server for us for Unreal Tournament 2003. Can you also, you know, do the client while you're there if it's going to be easy? And I was like, yeah, sure. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, you can hear the trouble right there. First of all, a server, often the user interface is secondary to the server code, so that probably is a lot easier to port, I would imagine.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if the whole game was all written to be a direct 3D game, it does become a bit more of a pain in the butt. But the interesting thing about game design, and this is also another innovation from John Carmack in the original Quake, was that the distinction between the client and the server is that one renders and one doesn't. But even when you're playing a single-player game on anything from Quake 1 on, when that became a revelation, really you're just playing on a server that's running on your machine and not accepting other people's connections.
Right.
So
right.
You're just pushing memory around buffers instead of over an Ethernet wire. But it's,
so they've already kind of decoupled the code, the engine from the display.
The engine from the display, and you're always running the server, even if you also happen to be running the client.
So you have to port the server anyway.
Yeah, I mean, so in most things, I mean, there's exceptions to every rule, of course, but Epic needed it because they needed the dedicated server, but they also wanted the client, and that's coincidentally paid off well for them because they actually have licensees that are licensing the engine from them for an enormous amount of money, specifically because they could do a Linux client.
Wow. Interesting.
So, and somewhere in Japan, there's an arcade machine that's running Linux with an Unreal title. So I don't think I can name names.
No, but that makes sense. Yeah.
But so, I mean, and in that sense, whatever meager amount they paid me for it, you know, they've tenfold returns on that financially, not just in terms of goodwill and server admins running the Linux server and stuff like that. But the reason I'm telling you this is that it occurred to me very quickly after working with Epic that chasing after individual games is a waste of time. And in the best of scenarios, you're going to fight and fight and fight and get a port of, I don't know, whatever the hot game of the day is, which won't be the hot game of the day next
month. The South Park game.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you joke, but there was a time when Loki Software was like, hey, this Daikatana game sounds hot. You know, right. We should get that.
A lot of people were saying that back then.
It had a mega hype machine, and it had John Romero behind it. So, but you know, the proof was in the pudding when it shipped. And we could have, if we had done that deal, we could have spent 6 months porting that game. And then been like, oh my God, it doesn't sell on Windows.
Nobody
that
wants
happened to
it.
Be, no one wants it, but that happened to be on a Mac port, actually, just recently, with a game called Men of Valor, that it was supposed to be this hot Vietnam shooter, which, frankly, I think is kind of an offensive concept in the first place. But, you know, this really cool first-person shooter in the jungles of Vietnam during the American War there, and you know, it just tanked. It tanked. It was rated the worst game of the decade by several magazines and stuff. And you wouldn't guess that from the hype and the marketing and people being excited about it. And, you know, that happens. You can't predict these things. So and even in the best case scenario, like, I think that Unreal Tournament 2004 was, by and large, a wild success, that we even in the Linux version of it. I've heard reports that we're actually have more people playing it on Linux than we have on Mac OS, just, you know, next time people try to lecture you about niche OSs. But what I'm saying is it occurred to me that chasing after Unreal Tournament 2004 in and of itself, not terribly worthwhile, because sooner or later it won't be the hot game. Actually, sooner than later it won't be the hot game. Getting the Unreal Engine, though, that's hot, because now there's 15 other titles this year that are going to be shipping with that. And they're just on their baseline from where the Windows developers started. It's portable to Windows, Linux, Mac OS, Windows 64, Linux 64, or AMD 64 specifically. But I mean, basically, all these doors are open if they start with a portable engine. And you have Timothy Bessay at id Software, their Linux guy, and I think he probably sees this the same way. And they're very eager to keep their games portable to Linux and Mac OS. And,
is Valve the same way? I mean, I imagine the Half-Life engine is just as valuable, if not more so.
Well, you have to understand, your question is it valuable? And the question is, who is it valuable to? You know, me being able to run a game natively on Linux is valuable to me, but it's not necessarily valuable to Gabe Newell at Valve.
Right,
so, them running Linux dedicated servers is incredibly valuable to them. I mean, they have like, what, like 100,000 Linux servers or something? I mean, that at that point, it actually affects their bottom line if their Linux server crashes. So,
so what engine ports have you worked on?
Engine ports? I've done... let's see. Unreal, through the past couple iterations, we're just gearing up for Unreal Engine 3, which is the new hotness. Unreal Engine 2 was Unreal Tournament 2003, 2004, Postal 2, you know, Devastation, a few other games that are
it important. Seems like a really good engine, not knowing anything about the code. It just seems like a great engine.
We're going to stay with that statement, too.
Okay. Not knowing anything about the code, that's what you're laughing at.
Yeah, no, I know what you were laughing at. You were laughing at me.
Well, technically, from a technological standpoint, Unreal Engine 2 was really, really good for its generation. And it's showing its age now. Yeah. You can tell when an engine's getting old because the first thing that happens is Windows developers license it and replace the renderer.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it's like, you know, you pay id or and you're seeing this on Quake 3 titles too, like both Medal of Valor and Call of Duty, which were both based on Quake 3, have both ripped out the OpenGL render and put a Direct3D one in. Because you need it as a bullet point on the box for this crazy sales world we have, where you go...
Well, also they want to migrate their way into the Xbox and all the rest, you know?
But you could do that. You can do that anyway. I mean, it's not...
I know, because, the Xbox X3GL or whatever they call it, it's very much like OpenGL.
Yeah, and the PlayStation 3 is actually OpenGL.
Right,
so, you know, this works both ways. But what I'm saying is the technology is showing its age from a rendering standpoint, and a lot of people don't recognize good gameplay. They only recognize shiny pictures on the screen.
Did you work on the Valve engine at all?
I have worked on Steam a little bit because we just shipped a game called Red Orchestra, which is based on Unreal, but interesting, integrated into Valve's distribution system.
Oh, interesting.
Which was interesting. Valve has just enough on Linux to get their to accomplish what their specific goals are, which is get the games out to as many people as they can in terms on Windows. And if having a Linux server lets people stand up more Half-Life 2 deathmatch servers, they're going to do it, you know, and... the same thing for Red Orchestra for their dedicated servers, because it's really an online only game. There's a single player bot mode and it's kind of crappy, you know, as bot modes always are. The client side of Half-Life 2 is still very much under wraps. But even as late as, you know, a couple months before they were shipping it, they were talking about how they have fallbacks for everything back to DirectX 5 in that thing, which says to me they have a nice rendering abstraction. You could probably just plug an OpenGL renderer into that thing and go. Right. You know, what could possibly go wrong? But but Valve has been the last holdout. Every other major engine has been Linux compliant and considers it a bullet point for both their end users and their licensees who demand it in some cases.
Interesting.
And, you know, I don't think that's going to change in the near future.
So,
but.
So your skill set really is, when you're talking about being a porter, is...
Yes, I carry things.
You're good at carrying things in your head without a...
Drayage, boy, drayage!
Well, it's the Latin for porting is porto, which is to carry. So, that's what we're doing is we carry things to new platforms.
Right.
So.
Right.
That was your lesson for the day. If you're stuck in Latin class,
now you said
like
you
I
use
was.
SDL to
yes, SDL. The Holy Grail,
the one true abstraction layer.
Yes, simple direct media layer. Direct media is one word. That's why it's SDL. But you can find this at libsdl.org, libsdl.org. It's an open source library. It's kind of it's been termed before, and I think it's probably a fair way to describe it, is it's the open source equivalent of DirectX. It's not a DirectX implementation. It's not like Wine or something like WineLib or something like that, but it gives you a nice clean abstraction over 2D video, over OpenGL context management, over audio, over input, over, you know, Windows system events, stuff like that. And basically, the problem with DirectX and DirectDraw and Direct3D is that if you want to do even a simple game, you end up with a couple hundred lines of boilerplate code, which just drives me nuts. I can't say it because nobody actually knows what that code does. They just cut and paste it from the DirectX documentation. And
all programming basically that.
I mean, no, not really.
You do that a lot.
Only with badly designed APIs.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
And if Microsoft said, look, Direct3D is gone, and it's OpenGL only, no one would cry. No one would shed a tear if that API went away. But everyone uses it, and even the Direct3D fanboys recognize that the value of Direct3D was that everyone writes drivers that support it.
Right.
Microsoft pushes it heavily.
Right.
You get some fairly interesting cutting-edge features pretty early with it.
Sometimes, but
video
even
cards are designed
time,
to support it. I mean, the hardware is written to it now.
Not really. Actually, Direct3D is written to the hardware. When NVIDIA says we have a new feature, the next version of Direct3D is really basically NVIDIA 4.0
really,
or
because
whatever it is.
It often seems like DirectX 9 came out, and then the hardware started to support those features.
Yeah, well, there's a certain lag, but let's not pretend there's no communication between them. NVIDIA says, John Carmack wants this in the next thing.
So it really starts with John Carmack, who says, I need vertex shading, and then NVIDIA says, I'm implementing vertex shading, and then Microsoft says, okay, we'll put it in DirectX.
And we'll make it with the API clean for what NVIDIA wants, or ATI, whoever's the hot guy that week.
Interesting.
Whereas the interesting thing with OpenGL, and this is worth noting, is that that's why Direct3D seems to go largely on product cycles of video hardware.
Yeah, that's true. But,
and, you know, that's fine when you're NVIDIA or ATI, but, you know, let's see.
Only NVIDIA and ATI now.
Well, don't say that, because if we go back to, say, 1999, I'm going to get a hot ATI card you would have laughed at.
No, that's right.
Fast one, you know. Right. So it works that way. But when you have these two competing companies, competition is good, but when you have just two competing companies and they control the video API, then you really have locked out the third party. You know, they're really always going to play catch up to whatever the API does for
NVIDIA's
hardware.
They're not in on the conversation.
Yeah, well, they're not, and they can't be, because that's just how it works. I mean,
look what happened to Vudu, right? You
know. Well, Vudu had
that was another
mistakes,
issue,
but we won't get into that right now. But the interesting thing about OpenGL is that, you know, if it's all extensions based, you say, which has its own problems programmatically, but it allows the vendors to say, here's OpenGL, here's how you get things to the screen, but here's a cool feature that only my hardware does. We're exposing it as an extension. You can check for it. If it's there, you can use it.
Right.
And hey, if we make it nice and clean, NVIDIA can implement it too and stuff, but you're not locked into when Microsoft says we're doing the next DirectX, and you get to come to the table with your own stuff.
Is OpenGL actually open?
Open in terms of source code, or
I mean, is it open standard? I mean,
it's an open standard. There's what's called an ARB, which is an architecture review board, which is made up of NVIDIA, ATI, Matrox, Apple, basically all the major hardware vendors and all the major OS people. I think Brian Paul from Mesa actually was involved in some way at some point, or had a voice but not a vote. I'm a little vague on it.
The Linux driver.
Yeah. Oh, he's the guy who wrote the original Mesa, which is the original OpenGL for Linux. And
So SDL is an interface between these DirectX calls and the operating. What? Where? How does it?
Okay, this is how it works. I was saying before that there's boilerplate. You always have the same piece of code to get a Direct3D video context that you can start drawing into, and it's like 100 lines of code, and it's got these really cryptic error messages, and you have to like use these hresult things. It's a mess, but SDL, it's one line to get your video mode up there. You call SDL set video mode, you know, 640 by 480, 32 bits, go! And it just goes.
That's because SDL has the 100 lines of code in its library, though, right?
Yes, and it's written in TCL, TK.
Oh, it's Tickle, really?
It's actually, no. it's written in C. But
you fooled me for a minute there. I thought you did.
I was like, what? I don't remember that.
It's funny, I was reading Slashdot because Google Earth just shipped. I love having my, you know, ego destroyed by people who don't know better on Slashdot. And one of the guys was like, this Google Earth isn't impressive. I could write this in 100 lines of TCL, TK. And I'm like, that might be the new net meme. Like, after all your base belong to us. Yeah, I could write that in 100 lines. We need to get that on like a t-shirt or something.
No, maybe I better back up a little bit. It sounds like you had something to do with Google Earth. Was this your project?
Well, it was. I wouldn't say it was my project. I did the Linux version of
it. You ported Google Earth to Linux. That's cool.
Well, and this is what I'm saying is that, I mean, it ran on Windows, it ran on Mac OS, but this is what I'm saying is you got to have this scattershot approach and say, you know, we're not going to push Mac OS as an alternative to Windows. We're going to push everything we can as an alternative
that's
practical and reasonable. I don't speak for Google. I should probably say
They're not writing a BOS version at this point or a Palms 5 version. But
BOS doesn't have the GL drivers we need, even if we wanted to do that. But you have to be reasonable, too. And, you know, I think anyone would say that portability is only nice to a certain point. And, you know, the PDA version of Quake 2 is going to be quaint, but, you know.
Why?
But when there's actual dollars on the line and developers being funded for it, you want to try to be reasonable in targeting this, but you want to try and get this diversity of platforms.
So I had I mean, this is actually a much more timely interview than I realized. So
you're welcome.
Yeah, that's great. So you just shipped a pretty important product out there.
Yeah, and well, I think, and I said before that I get all these emails like, oh, if there was only this title on Linux, I would totally, you know, delete my NTFS partition. But
I say that all the time, actually.
Well, everyone does, and everyone has their one game. And frighteningly, that game doesn't change as often as you'd think for an individual. Like, there's probably still people waiting for that Linux version of
Chopper,
you know,
Command.
Half-Life 2.
One of these days.
Well, Half-Life 2 is the big one. Seriously, yeah. Everyone's waiting for it. And frankly, you'll never see it. And I think you have to say with certain titles that they are only games and you have to move on and say, you know, you can find entertainment elsewhere if you absolutely have to. And there's too many people that run out and buy the Windows version of it just because, you know, that's like the most important thing to them, I guess. But Google Earth was interesting because it's not just a game. It actually has more than that hour of entertainment value, even if you are just flying around the Earth and doing nothing. But, you know, it saved lives during Hurricane Katrina. It's handy. It's handy. I mean, it's just, you can, I don't have many stories for this. I saw that on Slashdot and I'd heard that story before, so I don't think it's actually fake, but.
No, it's true.
I thought it was, but you know, it has a utility. It has not just a utility for fun, but it's also a utility for making the world a better place. And, you know, I want that on Linux. I want that on Mac. I want that everywhere. I don't want to have to boot Windows to make the world a better place. But, so that Google Earth was important to me for that.
That's great. That's an exciting thing. Now, you ported beta, the version 3 and version 4 of the beta, yes?
We started with version 3, but, I mean, the Windows and Mac people were obviously rapidly moving towards beta.
Right. 4. So you can get 4 on Linux right now.
Yeah, and it's, we're not going to do 3. There's just
why
no
bother?
Sense.
I mean, right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You know, yeah, technology nice. Marches on.
It, well, it does march on. Features march on, and you know, it's.
Is it OpenGL?
Yes, it's ironic. On Windows, it has OpenGL and Direct3D support. Direct3D is the fallback. Like, if your hardware's crap.
if you can't do OpenGL.
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's a problem on... Well, ironically, it's a problem on Windows. It's going to go away on its own. But on Windows, you know, you might have really good hardware, depending on your definition of really good, but you might have really good hardware, and the Direct3D drivers are really good, and the OpenGL ones are bad, like crash on startup bad.
Right, right.
Ironically, that goes away in Vista. Because they're going to layer OpenGL on top of Direct3D, and you won't be able to do shaders, but just about any other modern feature of OpenGL is guaranteed to work on anything that's got a Direct3D driver.
Really? Is that for Aero that they did that, or
no? It's just the general operating system.
That kind of
sure.
stinks.
Why does that stink? That's
because
great.
It means OpenGL apps. I mean, yeah, they'll run, but they'll lose some of the advanced shaders. And
well, you can install an NVIDIA driver.
Oh, okay.
But
right.
You have that crappy Intel integrated graphics chip that, you know, has the driver that, you know, Sony put on it because it's a VAIO and you can't get updated drivers.
Right. As long it'll as still work.
It'll work, and it'll work significantly better than OpenGL does on most Windows computers nowadays. So I don't know why Microsoft did it. Originally, they were talking about not doing that, and frankly, in terms of platform dominance, they're shooting themselves in the foot by doing that.
Yeah.
And I'm all for that. So, I mean, it makes my life easier because, frankly, I think OpenGL is a better API, and I think that it allows more community consensus and individual contribution than Direct3D ever will. So, in my mind, that has to win out in terms of technological Darwinism. Whether it wins out business Darwinism is another question, and Microsoft might have just made that decision for us in our favor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are being this army that I'm amassing in this room while we talk.
it's the royal hour.
They're very small. You have to
hidden in the carpet.
Yes.
we're about to wrap up. This is so fascinating, but I would like to just get back to a question which you really never answered. But how you yourself personally, and you're obviously a little shy about talking about yourself personally, but I think. How you yourself got into this and the path, whether the path you took was. Is an appropriate path for others. I mean, you started with games. I think that's true. I think many of us did. Did you start with BASIC?
What programming language did I start with? Quick BASIC 4.5 on DOS.
Yeah.
Brother.
Yeah.
Represent.
I did some GW BASIC, but yeah, I rolled right into Quick BASIC.
All right. Well, I mean, it's at the time. Well,
did you try Quick C?
They had a Quick C?
They had a Quick C.
No, I never tried.
Briefly.
It was actually Rogan.
It's funny, actually. I did a C program for a high school exit project, and it's in Subversion at iculus.org if you want to see it. And it's just, you could tell it was written by a basic developer that needed to get it running.
a lot of Go subs.
deeply embarrassing. And, that's neither here nor there. You said we're wrapping up. I wanted to mention SDL. The real point is not that it's a better API than DirectX, although in many ways it is. But
it just encapsulates it.
Well, it encapsulates DirectX, but on Linux it encapsulates X11 or FBCon if you're doing 2D stuff on a console. Or on Mac OS, it'll wrap the Cocoa layer and give you OpenGL.
So there's SDL for Mac as well.
Well, there's SDL for everything.
Oh, that's neat.
And it's
do people develop in Windows? We use SDL in Windows?
Sure.
I know of a couple commercial projects, like smaller scale indie games that use it. I know a lot of...
Doesn't Torque use it?
I thought it did. Sure. It doesn't use it on Windows, I'm pretty sure. But
so it sounds like it's worth learning.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's so worth learning. I mean, if you're a game developer, that's where you start.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be a game developer. You should be a developer before.
There's not a lot of overhead in it?
No, not at all.
It stays out of your way.
In terms of performance, there's no overhead whatsoever. I mean, like, we'll run it through Shark on Mac OS, and it doesn't even show up in the profile.
So once you compile it, it's compiling it back down to the low level.
Well, I mean, it's going through, you know, the SDL functions to figure out what platforms it should, what it should be doing on a given platform. Right. And, you know, even on Linux, it might be like, well, on this run, we have an X server, so we'll use X11. But, this guy's running without an X server. But, we can get it to the frame buffer console. We'll use that.
Wow.
So, and it handles that behind the scenes. It tries to do the right thing and pick the right thing. But
so it sounds like it's more than a library.
It's a very smart library. It's not – it stays out of your – the simple part of
it. Does it have a precompiler or something? I mean, what is
no.
it?
No. It's just a very clean, simple API, and it just does the right thing behind the scenes.
That's neat.
And the thing is, we're very strict about this, that the simple direct media layer, the important word there is simple. And there's been a lot of API things where people said, we should totally do this. And we go, no, that's ugly. That's too complex. That won't work well. That's very important to us. But the remarkable thing, and you hear this over and over and over again, is that people have something they wrote on Linux, and they're like, I thought I'd try compiling it on Windows, and it just compiled and ran and did the right thing. And we tried it on the Mac, and it compiled and ran and did the right thing. And, you know, we tried it on the Palm Pilot, and it didn't start up. But, you know, it would have done the right thing. And things like that. But I'm using it in commercial games, like Unreal Tournament on 2004, and almost anything I do that's graphical, like a game client for Linux or Mac, is using SDL, even if I had to replace the Windows code for it. So it's definitely, it's enterprise ready, but it's robust enough for that, but you can dive right into that, and you can write Tetris in a night with it. So it's clean. It's easy to use. It's simple to use. It stays out of your way. It's not a hassle. It's open source and it's actively developed, and there's a lively community that wants to help you write games.
That's cool. So
it's remarkable.
If you're a young guy or gal starting out and you want to write Tetris.
Don't discount the women here.
No,
we don't have enough women in the game department.
And
frankly, that's because everyone says guys instead of gals.
Yeah, well, from now
so
on.
You're
part of the problem here.
Say, if you gals want to develop for... But see, if I say that, it really sounds weird. It sounds like, guys, you should learn DirectX and OpenGL. But if you gals would like to program, SDL is the way to go.
Yeah, it's like Barbie fashion designer or something, right? You get
DirectX
GI Joe,
is hard.
Which, by the way, was a huge selling game.
Yes, well, actually...
I bought a copy.
Ashley and Mary Kate, what are their names?
Mary Kate and Ashley.
Yeah.
Their Game Boy game was a massive seller.
Yeah.
Really? I kid you not.
My daughter had it.
Yeah, and there's no denying that women and girls play games differently than boys and men do.
I don't think we should get too far into this topic, to be honest with you.
Well, they do.
And, whether it's by acculturation.
Well, it could be a lot of things, and frankly, I think it's partially because we force it on them, and I think that's shameful, but that's how it works right now. But I think a lot of it is like, how can we make these games more attractive to women? Let's stop raising Laura Croft's breast size. That's a good start.
That's a good start.
We won't get into that, Brent. Yeah. I mean, we do
now,
it
my daughter
badly.
Said, my daughter's 14 now. She said, I want to learn to be a hacker, Dad.
And I said, for her.
Great. I said, here's Pearl.
Well, don't give her Pearl. This is what I'm saying. You don't want to scare people off in the first week.
Bash. How about Bash Shell? I said, learn Shell or Pearl. There's your choice.
No, Basic. Basic or Logo. And you should tell people this. Like, Logo is the lamest language ever, but this will be the last time this will be about entirely
concepts.
Purely about creation. Yeah, after this, you're debugging linked lists.
Right. That's true.
Enjoy it while you can. So
Logo's a good choice. You're right.
Yeah. And seriously, if you are a programmer, mentor someone. You know, someone sends you an email and says, I want to learn how to program. You do not ignore them. That's your job in life. So,
I wanted to ask you, because one of the things that when you early on we were talking, it sounded like you said, write something that works. That's your first job right away. Don't get too fancy. Just write something that works. That's almost the Ruby on Rails kind of philosophy where, less prototyping, less design,
more buzzwords,
more coding. So, well, I know they're buzzword compliant, but it is, in fact, you get running code in
minutes. And the buzzword for this 10 years ago was rapid application development with Visual Basic.
Or case tools before that.
There's a definite value to that. I mean, don't try to be, complex, intricate, super crazy hacksaw dude. You want to actually, in fact, be quick and dirty and running, and you'll still be proud of it when, you know, you finish your first Tetris. So, I mean, and after that, you can learn elegance, and you can be edified by that, but that's the second step. The first step is not drowning, because programming is, I heard this in somewhere before, and I think it's a great term, is programming is less about, when you first start, it doesn't matter if you have a good teacher, you have good resources, you have a good programming language, the first day of programming is less about being thrown in the pool to see if you swim. It's more about being thrown off the cliff to see if you fly. So,
I like it.
Start flapping your wings. And, you know, if you make it to day two, it's easy after that, you know. And so,
I think that's a great
And if you
way
don't, to... there are plenty of other career paths.
Well, and, you know, not everyone's going to be a programmer, you know. Yeah. I think that's probably worth saying. But, and even people say they really, oh, I really want to write this game, or I really want to, you know, be part of the open source community, which I think is great, because frankly, you know, sometimes belonging to a community is worth more than actually producing something. I think that's worth saying.
I agree.
Even if you're one of the jerks on Slashdot YouTube, although, that counts.
There are a lot of very normal people.
A great way to be a participant in a community, though, is to create something.
I agree. You know, but not everyone's a creator. Some people are, I mean, you need tech support. You know, you need people that are going to go, it's okay, we can walk you through this. Or more to say that more important than the surgeons in the hospitals are sometimes the nurses.
Oh,
actually, every time
always.
Is the nurses. So,
except for right during that one small period of time.
Yeah,
Just during the incision, but after that.
But, you know, sometimes the ugly jobs are far more important. And,
no, I agree.
In many ways, the argument is this is where open source falls down. But, you know, I think that we tend to highlight the negative cases. I mean, I've seen some remarkable things happen in IRC channels. And I've seen, you know, just really great people do great work and on forums and email lists and such like that. And that's what's remarkable to me about SDL is that generally when people ask stupid questions, because, you know, frankly, sometimes questions are stupid. We were all stupid at one point, too. You know?
Oh, man, was I an idiot.
Some of us are still stupid. Please, Ryan, let's not leave me out here.
Oh, no. I'm sure I'm great. You're going to write that Tetris clone tonight. You let me know.
I might. You email it to me. I might.
But seriously, if people come in, they'll ask something that, you know, is really an incredibly basic question. And, you know, people are just enthusiastic to help. They're like, oh, you don't want to do it that way. You want to try this. And we found this worked well, but don't get into that yet. You know, and that's really exciting to me. I mean, that's almost more important than the guy that, you know, everyone recognizes Linus Torvalds, but the credits file is very, very long, you know.
So, and mentoring is very important in this. I think you're right.
I agree.
Yep. So, well, Ryan Gordon, really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
I think we covered a lot of subjects. We never did find out how you got started. But I don't care anymore.
We'll bring him back.
We can always bring him back.
Ghostbusters on the Commodore 64.
And thanks, Ghostbusters on the Commodore 64.
If you haven't gotten it, get an emulator. Play it.
Yeah, that's right.
It's ghetto, but it's amusing.
It's our ghetto.
Yes, that's right. It's our hood.
Back to the shtetl and get back to work. We're looking for more Google Earth from you. I think great job. Thank you very much. Working on that. That's fantastic.
Thanks for talking to me.
Boy, that was fun talking to him. And I like the way that he didn't mention SDL till the very, very, very end, or the Google Earth till the very end. He's kind of a humble fella.
Well, he is, you know, and the thing is, his accomplishments can't be understated. If you care about games, you should care about Ryan's role in the game space. I mean, because we hear a lot about the John Carmacks, the Peter Moores of the world, right? But when it comes down to it, it's like, you know, Ryan can open up games for thousands upon thousands of new developers in ways that an Xbox developer kit never can.
Right.
And never could. So
he's been working on super secret project number 193741A at Google.
Well, you know, when we were talking about porting Google Earth, I was like, oh, I'd really like Ryan in for this, you know, because he's always been so very passionate about it. And the output has always been amazing. So I wanted to make sure that we talked to the right person if he was available. And it was funny, too, because I emailed him. I was like, so how's it going? And he's like, I'd love to port Google Earth. I'm like, well, there you go, then.
You're hired.
He's like, I'd almost do it for free. And I'm like, you're kidding, right?
No, don't say that.
yeah, pretty much.
You're talking to the wrong people.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, and he did a beautiful job, and we have it, thanks to Ryan. Thanks to you for bringing him in for an interview, because, boy, I thought he was just really... A pistol.
Yeah, I thought it was great, too.
Yeah. So we apologize for taking a week off last week, but we have a couple of interviews in the can. We'll get you. We've decided that the more inside interviews will be kind of a floss extras, and the interviews like this that are really of more general interest will be part of the main floss. That way you get extra floss. You can never have too much floss. Chris DeBona,
always
a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending a little time with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Leo.
All right. We'll see you next week on Floss Weekly.